This is Bonjour Chai, the Can't Get No Satisfaction edition. I'm Avi Feingold. I'm here with Phoebe Maltzvovi and special guest Adina Sash, better known as Flatbush Girl. We are your Frozen Chosen. On today's show, we talk about Agunot. We talk about sex strikes. We talk about the case of Malky Berkowitz. And stay tuned till the end for a very special Broigus from Phoebe about a literary debacle at the Guernica magazine. All this and more. Stay tuned. We are joined today with an amazing guest host. Joining us is Adina Sash. She's better known by her Instagram handle, Flatbush Girl. Phoebe, I know you're a Flatbush Girl also because you used to go visit your grandparents on East 15th, but the real Flatbush Girl is Adina Sash, let's be honest. She's known for online activism, often challenges these norms within the Orthodox community. The first one that I remember was From Women Have Faces. That became national prominence, called out the Orthodox media for going to absurd lengths to not show women's faces. Adina, welcome to Bonjour Chai.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit more about yourself, how you decided to form this Instagram account, what you do with it, and who you are?
Sure. So, you know, my whole life, I grew up in the Orthodox system, and I've always just felt that there was something below the surface related to the gender roles of men and women that wasn't sitting well with me. I always wanted to sit next to both of my parents during prayer sessions. I always wanted to be next to my grandfather, and I couldn't. I had to already from when I was a little girl, especially I developed very young. I already was fully menstruating by the time I was 9 years old. And so I was already, you know, sent to the back of the shul already from a very young age.
Oh, God. So wait, can we just step back for a second? I didn't know that the gender divisions would be based on whether you've had your period or not. So people would know if that this 9-year-old has had her period before.
Well, no, it's more about if you are physically, you know, everything about the divide is about protecting men from feeling any urges. So the role of the woman is to mute her sexuality and diminish herself so as not to evoke the libido of a man. That is essentially in a deconstructed sense what is happening when we talk about modesty rules. That's my.
And what about the women seeing the men? Is there any understanding?
No, no.
I know where I'm interested.
At the root of a lot of the issues, especially when it comes to in Agunah, a woman who is not receiving her religious divorce from a man, is, you know, this concept of women's libido and women's sexuality is secondary to, or not even secondary. It's really like just a footnote on preventing inappropriate sexual relationships. It's a very sexually centric sect of Judaism. I think the more the divide is between the genders, the greater the sexual tension.
The paradox is that the greater the amount of time that you have energy on increasing the ideas of modesty, you're sexualizing a community way beyond where it otherwise could be by just talking about it all the time or talking about avoiding it all the time. You're centering it as much as you're trying to. You think you're doing the opposite, but you're not.
Precisely. So my only point in mentioning that maybe that I had already had my period by the time I was 9 is that, you know, there was like almost like this like gaze up at my body, like, okay, you already have breasts. What are you doing in the men's section? Even if you're wearing a flower dress.
So this gave you, this kind of led to an awakening about these issues. So that's what you're saying, that this was what got you started thinking about these issues.
Yeah, I'm just saying that from already a young age, it's not like it was just something that casually went over my mind. Like anytime anything having to do with my gender came up, I was awakened. Something was not sitting right with me. And then as I got older, I wanted to sort of, you know, speak out about some of these injustices, but I didn't really know how. I didn't really have my voice yet. I didn't really have It just wasn't the right timing. And then the right timing sort of happened in around 2017, right after I had had my youngest son. My son is 8. So this is about 8 years ago, where I sort of just recognized that what was happening on social media and Instagram, so many Orthodox Jewish women were speaking about fashion, about wigs, about, they're beautiful things and they're wonderful. I do those things too. I love to going on, you know, I love these things, but you know, I felt like there was an opportunity for someone to come out and start calling out the sexual divide and the oppression against women.
Two questions actually about this. One is, you mentioned 2017. Was this to do with Me Too, the Me Too movement? Because that was when that started in the secular world.
No, it's just possible that I can't say for sure, but it is possible that at the time there was so much chatter in, you know, in the secular world.
I mean, I don't see how it would have been otherwise, because that 2017 exactly. is just such a huge. But my other question for you is just people who have awakenings like what you describe, where they realize that things are unfair in a traditionalist community that they grew up in, will often leave that community. What was it that led you to decide to stay put and sort of try to work for change from within?
So everyone has a different bandwidth and response to encountering injustice. And it's possible that different people have different levels of trauma. So maybe it is not responsible or healthy for them, or maybe they don't have the capacity or resources to stay and combat those injustices. I have grown up in a very privileged way. My parents are my biggest cheerleaders. I'm married for 8 years. My husband is my best friend. I, you know, have the financial liquidity to be able to take on risks. And I felt that my greatest contribution to the community that I care and love and am proud of being a part of was more about trying to make space for other girls like me who maybe felt trapped within and they felt like they had to be forced to leave. As the Orthodox insular community was shedding its exterior layers from the people who were leaving, I very much wanted to come and give a voice and a paradigm for and set a paradigm and make a precedent for women or anyone who's willing to say, I'm not going anywhere. And no, not on my watch. Not on my watch are you going to do this to my beloved close-knit community.
So just wanted to zoom out before we talk about divorce in the ultra-Orthodox community to talk a little bit about what's marriage in the ultra-Orthodox community, because I don't know. And so basically, are marriages, what age do they happen at for the man and the woman or the girl? Or as it were. And also, is it arranged marriage? Like how is it, how does it go basically?
Because so there's different flavors of what's considered normal or average based on, let's say the zip code that you go to, right? Mm-hmm. Imagine like, you know, there's in some areas it's normal where girls don't even go to a gap year in Israel and they just get married right out of senior year in high school. There are communities where women go maybe to 2 years of the gap year, they come back, they date while they're in school or they're in medical, like, but I can tell you how it worked for me. I know that, when, so, I mean, I've known my husband since childhood, but only sort of in 12th grade when I was a senior did I realize that like I was having my first full-blown crush. I had never touched, you know, had any experience with a male. And I was very, very sexually curious about being with this guy who is now my husband. And I was approaching my parents about these feelings. And they're like, there's only one way. You have to get married. I was like, but I want to like date him. I want to like go out with him. And they're like, yeah, you can spend time with him in the living room. And you have to get engaged and you have to get married. Because there's this a lot of paranoia, sexual paranoia around premarital sexual touch, even just touch. Mm-hmm. And so I had to fast track myself into the marriage because I thought there was no other way. And, you know, I was only 17 when I got engaged. I was married by the time I was 18. And even just that process of being the first girl in my senior class as such a, I think, feminist to go in, like to become a wife at such a young age. It was just, you know, it was hard to reconcile because I had to now take on covering my hair at 17 years old. I had to figure out how I was going to advocate for myself because it was not considered normal to go on birth control right away unless you already have children. So how am I going to advocate for myself to get that permission from the rabbi? Because I didn't want to become a mother. I just wanted to be intimate with a guy I had a crush on. And even like going to my training classes with a Kala teacher, who is a woman who teaches you pure family purity laws having to do with ritual immersions and the mikvah and things like that, which by the way, I'm a certified Kala teacher. And I also now have tried to reclaim some of that and empower women, you know, on those family purity laws to empower women versus telling them how they need to be a, you know, on what they need to comply with and be fearful of in the bedroom. Because the way I was taught my Kala classes by my teacher, I was told that oral sex is off limits. And I was told that I'm just going to get graphic for you because I feel like
that's fine. You know,
and I was told that any
this level, is the most racy show we've had yet. Go
and
for it.
All forms of ejaculation have to be specifically within a orifice that could potentially lead to conception. So that now two orifices are off limits.
Netty.
So when you're sexually developing as a 17-year-old woman and now you're walking down the aisle and you're getting married and now you have all these lists in your mind of all the things you are allowed to and not allowed to do having to do with your body, it's very frightening. It's very frightening. And even though my parents are my biggest supporters, and of course this was already 18 years ago, I'm married 18 years. So, you know, things are a little different now even out there in the world. There's been a lot of change. There's been a lot of progress that's happened, you know, with the use of cell phones, smartphones, social media. There's this underground liberation happening where women are not really asking permission for everything anymore, and they're making their own executive decisions. So now you have a group of women who are on the cusp of taking matters into their own hands, but at the end of the day, they're always going to be limited to the ceiling, and the ceiling is their liberty within their marriage, because the concept of a get, where the husband gives a religious document to free his wife and allow her to go remarry, that at the end of the day is still regulated from A to Z by a rabbinical court system that in most cases is fair and just, but for the few who are corrupt and greedy and money hungry and chauvinistic and misogynistic, those ruin it. Those bad apples ruin it for everyone else.
So who is Malky? We're going to step back and say who is Malky, and why is her case? Why are there airplanes flying with messages about her? Please explain.
So Malky is, in my opinion, the classic woman who has fallen through the cracks, and her obedience and compliance and trust in a system has led her into desperation. So she got married in 2015 to a man named Volvi Berkowitz, who she met for only 10 minutes. It's in a
And how old was she at the time?
She was about 23 years old and he was around 20.
Okay.
To be fair, that there is pressure nowadays, especially within the Hasidic community, to marry younger and younger because they're aware that people have libidos, especially boys, and they'd rather they get married earlier and channel their sexual energies in a technically appropriate manner than they, you know, possibly run wild and free in it. I know that there are accounts online that are specifically working to point out these cases where people are married as young as 15 and 16 because they're like, oh yeah, let's do this and let's get everybody married and let's make sure that everybody is following the right path. Malky got married 10 years ago. What has happened in the interim?
So she was unhappy. I mean, of course, people will say that everyone in retrospect, you know, says that they were never happy, but in truth, really in truth, she was unhappy from when she was engaged. She didn't know that she had autonomy or agency to end an engagement. She didn't know that she even had really a choice on picking who she would marry, because in that 10 minutes, everything seemed fine enough. And the people she was relying on to do research for her and protect her and make sure that she was marrying into a good family and getting a good boy, where she just blindly trusted them. She, you know, in text messages and in letters that she's written, which I'm happy to share with you later on, she says that she felt as though she walked down the aisle blindfolded. And that is sort of a nod to what she wore, her veil. It's called a dektich. A dektich is a solid piece of satin that is, the romance language used is that the bride's face is so holy that it is emanating the light of energy of God, and that you cannot gaze upon her face because she's so holy. But if you peel that back a little bit with more of a distrustful lens, it's also a way, it's sort of like a blindfold. And Malky herself refers to her dektich as a blindfold, that she was sort of sold into slavery or indentrified into a system where her voice did not matter, her needs did not matter, and she was nauseous and sick the entire week of Sheva Brachos, which is the 7 days after the wedding ceremony where the couple has nightly celebrations with the community and family, where she felt a big knot in her stomach and she felt frightened and alone, and she knew something was wrong and she didn't know how to sound the alarm. And then before you know it, she was pregnant and in the system. And divorce is not something that is taken, forget about, lightly. You're considered an absolute failure in the Hasidic community if you're a Jewish woman who initiates divorce.
Judaism is different from some other religions that like just don't allow divorce at all. But under what, which conditions can somebody ultra-Orthodox get divorced, and how does that generally go?
So it's a little complicated, but I'll just try to summarize it. Divorce is something that we have a history of understanding it exists. Culturally, it's been something frowned upon, but in terms of our scripture and our legislation books, it's something where it's studied extensively, and there's a lot of sympathy and humanization for both parties. And it is often seen through the lens of mutual release, where each party is releasing the other. The husband has to give it and the woman has to receive it. However,
so what, can you explain, sorry, what that means? Husband has to give it and wife has to receive. What does that mean?
So it's almost like a chain of custody document on a woman's womb, so as to establish paternity in the event of any questions. So it's sort of like a, here, you're no longer mine to reproduce with. Okay. Women wait about 90 yeah. days to get remarried. So we're in the clear, right?
Pregnancy tests
didn't exist back then.
Right, of course. Right?
And then the woman accepts it. And sometimes women resist on accepting it because they don't want to end their marriage. Mm-hmm. And those cases are much more rare than a husband who doesn't want to give it in the first place.
Okay. I understand. Thank you. That was helpful explanation.
The important thing that's here is that because the writ of divorce needs to be initiated by the man, a woman who says, I want to get divorced, and the husband who says, I do not want to get divorced, right? That's where you start having all sorts of legal issues.
So are these couples that have also married in the civil system as well?
Like, yeah, sure.
They're also
well. You okay. have to. I can tell you, most part, you legally cannot get religiously married without getting legally okay. married. Okay. If I, as a rabbi, do a religious ceremony without a legal ceremony attached to it, I know, at least in the laws of Canada, I can lose my ability to do marriages beyond that. But it doesn't mean that it doesn't happen all the time. Anyways.
Sure. Okay.
That's the community. It's not true. In my marriage, not. I got my civil marriage months after I got religiously married, and as did Malki. Malki was married for months before she went to a courthouse and got her marriage certificate.
Well, these cases where a woman will have also been divorced in the courts, but then the man is not doing the final religious step, or has she not gotten divorced in the courts? Has the couple ended the marriage officially legally, like in the courts also?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no.
Sometimes yes, okay. Okay. Because I mean, so what this is preventing her from doing is staying within the community and forming a new partnership, but not necessarily, it doesn't necessarily mean that she would be considered having two husbands if she found a new husband outside of that community.
Listen, well, religion,
for her, it wouldn't be,
depending how she feels about it, but that's.
Religion is something you opt into. So is it actually true that she cannot go and have another husband? She could go marry another 100 men if she wants to, and she can do whatever she wants.
Well, no, she couldn't, because the law of the US or Canada certainly wouldn't allow that.
So it's not so much about marriage. It's more about sexual relations. It's not necessarily about this is my husband, this is not my husband. It's more that she's forced to wear a chastity belt that her husband is locking on
her. So on that note, we want to ask about the sex strike. What is happening specifically in terms of a sex strike and a mikvah strike specifically?
So it's really an invitation for each person to opt in on a level that they feel that, you know, works for them and their lifestyle and their passion about, you know, their passion. It is really an invitation to go on a full sex strike and a mikvah strike from when it was announced until Malki is free. I believe that if this is something that more women would be vocal about opting into, Malki could be free within 48 hours. But if women or couples are not comfortable with this, then at the very least, it is a request to please join us for refraining from sexual activity on Shabbos, because it's our way of standing in solidarity with Malki and all women who are in chained marriages, who are deprived of sexual relations while they are stuck in limbo waiting for their husband's permissions.
I'm just wondering, how has this been received? Have there been people who have said that they're planning on doing this? Have you been receiving numerous people? Are there husbands that are complaining that they don't want to be part of the sex strike, but they have no choice because their wives are not going to the mikvah and they don't want to rape their wives, so their wives are saying no, and it's pissing them off and it is causing action? What has been the... 100%.
We're seeing women who are finally recognizing that just because it's mitzvah night or mikvah night, maybe their body is something they get to make an executive decision about. And if they wanted to postpone that they're allowed to. And it's creating, I've had calls from rabbis. I've had calls from husbands. I've had calls from wives who say, thank you for telling me this is something I'm even allowed to do, and rabbis freaking out and saying that I'm destroying the community. And that I even had a rabbi who called me who said that once you tell the women that this is something they can even consider doing, you open the door for something, you open Pandora's box. I'm like, that's exactly the point.
I've heard from women, and because we teach couples all the time, my approach is never to, you know, the men teach the men and the women teach them the women. I say marriage is co-ed and you should be able to learn about sexuality and sex in a co-ed manner. So, you know, we've heard this from couples who have heard it from, you know, from other people that, you know, you get this sense that women are afraid sometimes to ask for sex because then they feel like it makes an obligation on their husband and they don't want to create obligations. And I'm like, just have a communication, talk to each other. And what you're saying is now this is a reset almost, the first time in a modern era and in a long while where people are becoming aware that sex isn't just a given.
Yes, absolutely.
So sex strikes have a big history. They were talked about a lot. I mean, there's the Lysistrata play where this happens. But with Me Too, there was a lot of talk of sex strikes or talks of sex strikes to do with, like, I think abortion laws in the States as well. Like this comes up a lot and in modern times. But what I always wonder about this is, to me, it seems like a little bit, it assumes that sex is something men want and women don't. So explain to me why that's wrong.
It actually uses the same logic. It's the point is to showcase a mirror to how the get process works, where women who, when they cannot move on and be sexual when they want to be, the rabbinical court systems do not prioritize the female libido. They say, if the male is saying, I need to get out of this marriage, she's not accepting the get, help me force her to take a get, there are loopholes around that. You could get a signature from 100 rabbis who, even if the woman is being told, here, take the get, and she says, no, I don't want it, he could get 100 signatures from rabbis who say, she's crazy. You don't need to give her a get. Just go move on and leave her, right?
Of all the forms of protest, if the point is to emphasize women's need for sex, a protest in which women deny themselves sex just seems...
So, Phoebe, this is where I think you're wrong. It's not about the need
for sex. But they aren't having sex, right?
It's about agency. And if women don't have agency in marriage, they want to be able to show we can have agency when it comes to our bodies and our sex lives. If I may understand correctly, you know, Adina, that like... what she's saying instead is saying, I want sex just as much as you do, but I'm willing to forego it to raise this larger question of what's happening in a community.
And also just show to amplify what the issue is from what's going on with the divorce process, meaning when the husband wants out and the husband wants to leave, that can be fast-tracked very quickly. It's not often that a husband is chained to a dead marriage. It's a very rare, unusual occurrence. So why is that? Because the male need for sex is prioritized by the rabbinical courts. It's like an urgent thing. If a man says, I need to get remarried, I need to go have sex with a woman, it's like, oh my God, it's like you're calling for, the, you know, you're triggering the emergency dispatch system. But if a woman says, I am in that situation and I have needs too, you can wait. It's okay. You don't really have needs. You don't really have a libido like the male libido. So just wait a bit. It's okay for you to wait a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. We're going to figure it out. We're going to crack the case, but just give us time to have negotiations with your husband, who's your hostage taker, and we'll get to it. So it's literally a mirror for the way that they assume that a woman has so much control over her libido. So we're going to give a taste back of the same medicine. If you think we have so much control over our libido, then we're going to show you that we have control over our libido. And we're going to show you that we're not going to do exactly what you say when you say, and we can use and weaponize our sexuality to free our chain sisters. I see it.
So I see that you have gotten some pushback, as I'm sure you know. And from what I could see on Instagram, it seemed like there were people who were saying that given all that's happening in Israel and Gaza, this doesn't make sense to bring up. That seems a little silly to me. But then I wanted to talk about a recording that you posted from a woman who did get her get, who in this recording, she threatens to sleep with all the men in a congregation.
I don't know if I ever told you or not, but... when I wanted my divorce, my Rav was like, you should wait, don't do it. You know, he had already moved out and the rabbi was like, I didn't even know you guys were having problems. You should wait. So I was so enraged. I said to him, I said, listen, I said, this marriage has been dead for years. I get zero help. And if you don't tell to give me my get, I will come down to your congregation as a married woman and I will every single one of your congregants one way or another, and you will all burn in hell with me. And if that doesn't work, I will take my two kids so fast and so far out of yeshiva, and I will go marry an Italian or and you will have ruined three Jewish lives. So please do me a favor and tell my husband to give me the get, and let's all continue living on the path of Torah. Verbatim, this is not exaggerated, the cursing, the threatening to bang all the people in his congregation. But I was so f***ing enraged. And I got my get 2 weeks later.
I wanted to talk about that recording because I have never heard anything of the kind in my life. And it was super interesting, but I want a context for it. So what was going on there?
There's a woman who wanted to get divorced. She felt that she...
This is a woman you know who contacted you. Yes, something like that? Okay.
I know her and she contacted me to share her story. Okay. She was in a marriage that she was unhappy in for years, and she finally felt the empowerment to leave when she, and also a lot of women are stuck in cycles of abuse. So if a woman is finally clear-headed enough or empowered enough to say, I am not going to be part of this cycle of abuse, sometimes you have a small window from which she can free herself. And then when she gets pushback from a rabbi who says, think about it. Let's give him time. We can't demand that he gives you the religious divorce document right away. Let's let this, you know, let's see where this goes. Let's process, right? So it triggered such a rage in her because she finally felt empowered enough to free herself. And yet she was getting pushback from a patriarchal system that was enabling her husband's abuse. So she thought of the one weapon she has that men cannot control, which is a woman's sexuality and who they know the men are not going to be equipped in their insular, orthodox, sexually suppressed system to deny a sexually voluptuous and alive woman who comes and tries to seduce them. Seduction of a female is a very common thread within religious history and within religious stories. The Esther in the Purim story goes and seduces the king in order to free her nation. Yehuda seduces the army general and then beheads him at night once he's in a stupor from the wine and cheese. This is seduction of females is a weapon that women have been deprived of using, even though it's in our historical history because of the modesty laws sent engineered through man-made constructs to to oppress our one area, not our one of our areas where we can checkmate men on their abuse of power. So this is a call to action for women to recognize that they are sexually stronger than they believe they are. And if that the men are going to weaponize aspects and abuse aspects that are in their control, then we are going to do the same. It is a form of sexual terror. That's the point.
You know, you're bringing up the Esther story. I don't know if you're aware of it, but for quite a while now, the Fast of Esther, which is coming up this week, has been made into the International Day for the Awareness of Agunot and various activist causes. What are the things that you think are working right now? Where do you think the things that still need to change that you think are going to be the place where rabbis are finally going to, you know, move in the direction of fixing this problem? And to me, like you said, the problem isn't the technical halachic problem. The problem is that the rabbis that are quote unquote in charge in these communities still see women as these passive beings that don't have sexual agency, that they don't realize that women are there. What are the things that are going to change? What are the things that are working? And what are the things that still need to go beyond that?
So the area that is, I think, going to help create a lot of progress is annulments, or really the proper terminology is really voiding the marriage. So voiding marriages has a lot of halachic and, you know, scripture-based precedent, and it has occurred throughout centuries by some of the greatest rabbinical minds. It's documented in the responsa and exegesis between medieval rabbinical scholars and leaders who have engaged in nullifying retroactively the contract of marriage based on certain avenues of where there was a full sale of goods and other areas, not just a full sale of goods, different areas.
For those of you who want to know more about this, by the way, one of the great resources is the International Beit Din that has a website. You can go search International Beit Din, and they will explain all the various methods that they do use. And there are courts that will do this for women and in full transparency and work on how they do that. And there's no secretive, you know, puppet string pulling. It's all there and it's all out front. Yeah.
Right. They write out exactly what the methodology is, almost in like a very clinical manner. And they follow the breadcrumbs of the past, bring it into the present, and they use documentation, medical records, they use whatever they can at their disposal to retroactively annul or void the marriage. The problem is that about 25 years ago, there was this huge coup where a lot of very right-wing extremist rabbis got together, published a book, and issued decrees and verdicts that this is no longer a methodology that we can implement, because the only people who can implement this is a Gadol Hadar, meaning a very wise sage, and no rabbis are on this level anymore. So now that we have fallen in our ability to be close to God, we no longer have the ability as men to void marriages. So we can only work within the confines of trying to convince the husband. We can't override the husband. The husband's agency is the final determination, and it is immovable and immutable. And that is the issue. The issue is that we need to undo that verdict and bring back the voiding of a marriage, which is a similar issue that took place, I believe, from what I hear from a lot of my followers. I have a very strong interfaith following as well. I have heard from people that in the Catholic Church, this was a huge issue where women couldn't leave their marriages also because they didn't have permission from their husbands, but that now the Catholic Church is doing more of the voidings. And so this is something we need to bring back. So I call it my slogan is bring back Bittel. Bittel means that you are nullifying it. So it's bring it back. It's not bring it in, it's bring it back. And if we do that, we will have a lot less get abuse, because the executive decision over the recalcitrant husband will ultimately lie within the rabbanit who are overseeing the divorce. And we won't just be at the mercy of possibly a deranged sociopathic abuser, domestic violent abuser.
Mm. So something that's interesting to me about a lot of this, again, coming from the secular world, is that in the secular world, really, there's been a lot of kind of pushback against sexual liberalism that was really the dominant way of thinking about things in the world I grew up in, where it was definitely assumed that, you know, young men, women, whoever, you know, have premarital sex with whoever they feel like. But there's been pushback saying that sort of the modern world claims to be the feminist way, but actually traditionalism is better for women because the hookup culture is bad for women and so forth. There's been this kind of move towards romanticizing traditionalism among people who either are or grew up secular. What's interesting here, though, is when you get the actual, it's more complicated, right? Like, I don't think that the secular world is always good for women. I also don't think that the romanticizing of what happens if you put a bunch of rules in place, you get other issues, I guess. And this is just an interesting reminder of the other issues that can come up.
It's all about choice, right? It's all about choice. If a woman wants to live within a domesticated frame of work, and she wants to submit to her husband, or she wants to be more docile or demure, you know, or cater to her husband's needs, right? That's wonderful for her to make that choice if she's opting into it with agency. But when it is done within a systematic style, there is, you know, it's, there's no one's opting into it. There is no other choice. You can't decide to, I mean, you could, if you leave the religious community, you know, people say all the time, oh, why can't Malki just leave? Why doesn't Malki just leave? Okay. So a woman who shaves her head every single month, because that's what her religion dictates her to do, wears a turban, right? And has not had any sexual liberty in her entire life, is going to, who has also been denied higher education, who's a preschool assistant, who's reliant on her family and friends and community to help her with the fact that she's a single mom who has not had any financial support or has not had documented financial, there's no, I mean, could it be they send $10 in the mail? I don't know, but has not had support from the father, right? How is she supposed to just pick herself up and start over? Do you know what kind of culture shock that is?
You have to remember, beyond that, you're talking about all the logistical pieces. She may actually believe in an Orthodox lifestyle.
Exactly. I forgot that. She's a firm, she's a fanatical believer. She tells me very often, Adina, you don't have to really do anything. God is going to free me. And we don't even need to do any levels of proactivity. We could all just sit back and pray, and God is going to divinely interfere and break my chains. And I cannot accept that.
I'm just curious, before we move off the topic, before we close off the topic, why Malki specifically? There's dozens of Agunot out there in the world right now, some who have been, you know, and not to negate anything, but like some of them have been around for much longer and who've been Agunot for a very, very long time. Why did you pick Malki? Why is all the protest centered around her right now?
You know, it's the same reason, like asking how did Seinfeld become a hit? It's just the perfect storm, the right people in the right place, the right mix. And it's not that I chose her; it's that the community has chosen her because her story resonates. I cannot force people to care about a story if they don't care about it. My only job is to report, present the facts, present the arguments. And it seems as though her story is really resonating, and though and people haven't even necessarily ever heard her voice or seen her face, and yet her story represents the faceless Aguna, the hundreds of Agunos in the tri-state area who we cannot even put a face to them, because, by the way, it just goes back to the original the original campaign I have, which is From Women Have Faces. Women are voiceless and faceless in the community, and the women who claim otherwise are either aiding the patriarchy or in denial or have internalized misogyny where they are threatened by other women in their neighboring community who are liberated enough to say, screw you, I'm not doing this.
Well, here's to hoping and praying that there are fewer and fewer agonot as the year goes by until this becomes a non-issue. I won't do a wedding. You know, we haven't talked about even the halachic prenup, you know, which I won't do a wedding without. I can explain it another time.
No, why don't you summarize it now? It seems relevant.
It's a document that basically says in the event that we choose to get a civil divorce, we both agree right away to go to a Beth Din before a civil divorce is taken care of. It's a legally binding document. It has different regulations in Canada versus the US. I always call it the anti-schmuck document, because if you see that your husband or your husband-to-be is kind of thinking twice about signing it, you sort of know that there's an issue there. And as I say, I want everybody to sign them, because then it becomes normalized and then we don't have to worry about it from that issue.
That's a great practical way of
Getting rid of it, but there are many men that don't, and there are many communities that still refuse to do it. And so that's why, for example, in the more modern Orthodox community, where the halachic prenup has become standard, where I can't think of any rabbis in my personal circles who won't do a wedding without one, the amount of recalcitrant husbands, the amount of agunot has dropped precipitously to become almost non-existent. This really only exists in the ultra-Orthodox community, where they reject this idea that, like, we need a document to help this happen. We are all hoping and praying that we get to a point where there are no more agunot, where this is just a natural process that can go to a court and people can get their divorces. We'd love to hear what you thought. Please tell us, email us, bonjour@thecjn.ca. If you know of an aguna, if you know of a case that you want to share with us, you want to tell us, your stories, or other people's stories, or just questions, email us, let us know what you think. We will be right back after these messages with our Nachas and Bruges.
Are you in the market for a new watch or a special piece of jewelry? Are you looking for the perfect engagement ring to pop the question? Atelier Lou has all this and more. Eric and the team at Atelier Lou can craft a piece for you, or you can select from some of the exclusive designers that they offer. From a simple bangle to a statement necklace, Atelier Lou can make you or your loved one sparkle. Located in the heart of Westmount in Montreal, or online at atelierlou.com, visit Atelier Lou for your next watch or jewelry purchase. And when you do, make sure to use promo code BON18 for 10% off your next purchase. That's atelierlou.com.
Adina, you're sticking around for our Nachas and Bruges. Tell us what your Nachas or Bruges is this week. Which one do you have?
I guess I had so much nachas when the grand rabbi of the YU community, Rabbi Herschel V. Schachter, he issued a public statement on the mikvah strike. And, you know, however you read it, you can parse through it and take away either something you want to be braggish about or have nachas from. It can be looked at through both lenses. And the lens through which I had a moment is there was a paragraph in there where he validated and acknowledged that there is precedent and it is endorsed that women within a tight-knit community, and I don't know how one wants to define tight-knit, I can argue on that word, but and women in a tight-knit community are permitted to use sex to encourage men in their community to help bring a husband to give a get, whether it's by denying sex or refusing to go to the mikvah. And yes, there are other paragraphs in that edict that, you know, maybe might make some people braggish, but that paragraph to me is something that I have gifted over to the next generation of women, that when they're sitting around the dining room table trying to figure out how to free an aguna in their neighborhood, that because of this sex strike, we have been able to force Rav Herschel V. Schachter into taking a position. And he clearly stated that within a tight-knit community, this endeavor is endorsed. So that is my gift to you, dear daughters.
To put it in context, when he was asked years ago if a woman can read a ketubah under a chuppah, right? The ketubah is the marriage document. His response was, of course, even a monkey can read a ketubah. So this is where this is coming from. And yes, he is a great rabbi with a great amount of knowledge and usually is very, very respected within the community. But there are some missteps that I will be the first one to point out that he's had. So thank you for that, Adina. Phoebe, nachas this week.
No.
Or Bregus.
Bregus. This week. Bregus this week. So this was indeed the topic of my column this week for the CJN's website. But the literary magazine, literary and political magazine based in the US, but all online, Guernica, retracted the publication of an essay by a British Israeli author named, I'm going to assume it's Joanna Chen and not Chen, since she is Israeli and not Chinese, but I don't know. Basically, it's this essay by this very much left-wing Israeli woman who writes about how she didn't serve in the IDF. She is not a religious woman. This was for other reasons. She helps Palestinians. She drives sick Palestinian children as a volunteer to hospitals in Israel. She is very, very much of the left. She writes, it's this essay about the idea of empathy and the challenges of kind of bridging that sort of divide during the war. And that was not left enough for the folks at Guernica magazine. This was considered by many there to be basically Zionist propaganda. A bunch of the people who work for Guernica, and I say work for in kind of scare quotes because it is an all-volunteer organization, so people who quit their job at Guernica are not quitting their job. But in any case, a bunch of people left. The magazine says it will be offering a fulsome apology. That's the word they used for this. And this has become a really big story. The Atlantic's covered it. The New York Times, Mark Tracy, right, who was a guest on our show, has, I believe, since covered. I haven't yet read his piece on it. The significance of this story for those who are not regular readers of Guernica magazine, and I have to count myself among those who are not regular readers of Guernica magazine, is that here's a case where somebody is being, this writer is being punished for the Zionism of basically existing while Israeli. Like, she couldn't be more impeccably of the left, certainly far to my own left, but that's neither here nor there. I'm not trying to write for Guernica magazine. But really, like, I'm trying to think, what was it that they were retracting? Oh, on what basis? Because basically there are lines that could be kind of misinterpreted to mean that she supports the war, which it doesn't even seem that she, like, you would have to really twist it. So it seems interesting. And I think that this, for a lot of people, seems to have kind of crossed a line where it seems like, no, this is not, this particular case is not about helping Palestinians. This is about basically saying, if you're Jewish and Israeli and you want to write an essay, not okay. So, I found this, it certainly is not a nachas. I guess it's got to be a broigus.
And it's bringing up big questions. You know, I want to follow this story because I think that there's stuff that is very Bonjour Chai-esque about it. So I think we should keep an eye on it. And if it develops further, if there's more, because I imagine that there very well might be, we should talk about it further. But thanks for bringing it up. I think that's it's an important one.
We have to wait for the fulsome apology.
Apology, yes. Absolutely. So my nachas this week is, when I was in college, I had a friend who used to say that the only reason why we have an Aguna crisis is because Uncle Moishe, who is the big kids, singer and talks about doing the right thing and mitzvahs and not singing Lashon Hara. The only reason why we have an Aguna crisis is because Uncle Moishe never wrote a song called Give Your Wife a Get. It's the right thing to do. And lo and behold, in 2011, there's a band that has a good Purim connection because they were called the Groggers. They have an album called There's No I in Cherem. And they're like a pop punk sounding, like typical 2010s. And they have a song called Get. And, you know, the refrain is you got to get, give her a get because she don't love you no more. Not only is there a song about giving her a get, there's also a song about mitzvah night and the power of having sex Friday night. But I want to alert our listeners, go check out the band The Groggers, go listen to Mitzvah Night, go listen to Get. Adina, you now have new music to put on all of your Instagram reels.
I'm going, I'm on my way. Oh my gosh, this is wonderful. Thank you so much.
My nachas is for the Groggers and their song Get, or the whole album, their entire oeuvre of doing pop punk around very insidery Jewish topics. Go check them out.
It's time to let her go, cause she seems miserable and bored. And your friends think you're a hero, but your kids think you're a joke. And your lawyer won't return your calls because he knows you're broke. You gotta get, give her a get. You gotta get, give her a get. You gotta get, give her a get. Cause she don't love you no more.
Thank you for listening to Bonjour Chai for the week ending March 16th, Shabbat Parashat Pekudei. Our producer is Michael Freyman, with technical production by Zach Kaufman. The executive producer for CJN Podcasts is Michael Freyman. Our music is by Sokol. We are a project of the Jewish Living Lab and are distributed by the CJN Podcast Network. You can listen to all our past episodes on our page at thecjn.ca/bonjour, and you can subscribe to the podcast and automatically receive all episodes on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you told a friend about Bonjour Chai. It is one of the best ways we get new listeners. And as always, you can email us with comments at bonjour@thecjn.ca.
You gotta get, give her a get. You gotta get, give her a get. You gotta get, give her a get. Cause she don't love you no more.